had a bad day? I mean, of course you have, right? I mean, a lot of you have probably had a string of bad days, maybe even bad weeks, bad months, or bad years. And it's true that to some extent, what quantifies a bad day is relative to what we know, but it looks like bad days start pretty young. For example, have you ever heard a parent, or maybe you parents have said this before about your infant child? Well, he's just not having a good day today. You know, he didn't get his nap, he woke up early, he's fussy or whatever. You know, even when our children are so young that they can't articulate for themselves that they're not having a good day, we can talk about how their day may not be going great. Now, a few weeks ago, when we were having nice spring weather, I was at a park, and there was a little girl there who was having a bad day. I mean, a really bad day. She was really having this epic tantrum, and it went on for a long, long time. To the point that some of the people I was with, we actually commented how we were impressed with the stamina of this little girl, that she just kept going. I mean, it was quite impressive. And now, once we get older, it's less likely that we kind of have a public meltdown like this little girl when we're having a bad day. Although I have a good friend who says she wishes it was culturally acceptable for adults to have kind of a public meltdown like little kids do. But it is true that there are kind of different degrees of what a bad day might look like. And, you know, sometimes our bad days are really just a series of kind of little things. You know, this or that happened that was frustrating at work, or we were annoyed by this. You know, we got cut off in traffic, whatever. But in the big picture, it wasn't that bad of a day. But when we think about the worst days of our lives, that pretty quickly becomes really heavy stuff. And if we were talking about the very worst days, I imagine for most of you, those would be days that involve loss of some kind, whether death or betrayal or the loss of a job or really the end of any kind of relationship. And this week, we are getting ready to remember what is definitely one of the worst days for the church and probably one of the worst days for the world. As we move into Holy Week and as we get closer to Good Friday. Now, it's only in hindsight that we refer to Friday as Good Friday, and it almost has a sense of irony to it. And like so many times in our lives, it begins really strong. I mean, today, this morning, as worship began, we had our children parade all the way around the top and the littler ones here across the front waving palm branches because it's Palm Sunday. And on that day, Jesus rode into Jerusalem and people were waving their palm branches and putting their cloaks out in front of him as he came in. And they were offering praise and shouting Hosanna and worshiping Jesus. And I gotta believe that at this point, if you're one of the disciples, you're thinking, you know, following Jesus, it's had its ups and downs. You know, I mean, we're in good days and bad days, but I think we are really hitting our stride now, you guys. I mean, look at this. Look at all these people who've gathered to worship Jesus. Jesus is the hero here. But as we know, the tide changes so quickly. For later on that week, part of why they're in Jerusalem is because it's Passover, which is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, festivals on the Jewish calendar. And Passover is when they celebrate that God passed over the homes of all the Israelites in Egypt when the firstborn children were killed. And it marks the catalyst for God freeing the Israelites from slavery and oppression in Egypt. And so this is a time of a great celebration. And so Jesus and the disciples, like they would have done for their whole lives, gather on Thursday for the Passover feast. And I'm going to be reading throughout this from Mark, and so I'm going to start in Mark chapter 14 at this dinner, and this is all from the Message. And Mark, this is Jesus talking, and Jesus says to his disciples, "I have something hard but important to say to you. One of you is going to hand me over to the conspirators, one who at this moment is eating with me." Have you ever had to share a meal with somebody who's deeply hurt you or betrayed you? Have you ever had to put on a smile and pretend that everything is okay for the sake of others around you? Maybe you've been in a situation where has been a divorce or something in the family at a wedding or another time, and it's so painful that people work the whole time so they don't even have to interact with each other. Well, Jesus's bad day, really day and a half, it begins with a meal, sharing a meal with a betrayer. Then after dinner, they go to Gethsemane and Jesus asks all of his disciples, I need you to pray. And then Jesus goes on a little bit further, and in verse 33, it says, he plunged into a sinkhole of dreadful agony. He told them, I feel bad enough right now to die. Stay here and keep vigil with me. I love the way the Message describes this, that Jesus fell into a sinkhole of dreadful agony. Because that creates all kind of imagery for me, and none of it is good. I think about being stuck in a hole. I'm thinking about darkness. It's damp. There's no way out. I'm definitely terrified, lonely, in despair. And Jesus says, agony. And perhaps the only comfort that Jesus may find at this time is knowing that his closest friends are there with him and that he's asked them to pray for him. But if you're familiar with the story, you know what happens. That three times Jesus walks over to the disciples, and what does he find? They've fallen asleep. They couldn't even stay awake to pray with and for Jesus. And Jesus gets more and more frustrated until finally the third time when he wakes them up, he says, it doesn't even matter. My betrayers are here. And sure enough, there appears Judas and what the Message describes as a gang of ruffians who have come to arrest Jesus. And suddenly all of the disciples vanish. The Message says to the disciples that they cut and run. Another translation says all the disciples deserted him and fled. And so suddenly Jesus finds himself deserted and alone from all of his friends. And he's being arrested. The next morning, Jesus is brought before Pilate. And there's a huge crowd that has gathered because thousands among thousands of people have come to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. And so there's all of these people who have gathered. And it was a tradition in the Roman Empire that they would release a prisoner during the festival of Passover. And so Pilate comes out to the crowd and he says, who do you want me to release to you? Barabbas, who was a murderer and an insurrectionist, or Jesus? And the crowd starts yelling, Barabbas, we want Barabbas. And so Pilate asks them, well, what do I do with the man you call the king of the Jews? And the crowd starts yelling, crucify him, crucify him. Now, I can't imagine what it would have felt like in that moment to have an entire crowd of people turn against you. This mob, this angry mob against him. I mean, if all of you in this room right now were to immediately decide that you hated me and started telling me so, I mean, this is the kind of thing I have nightmares about. Really, everything about this day so far represents some of my worst fears. Being betrayed by the people closest to me. Being left all alone and abandoned by my family and friends, being arrested. And now Jesus stands before this mob who not only is seething with hatred, but they're calling for his death. They may as well be chanting, kill him, kill him. And so Pilate turns him over to be crucified. But now before Jesus must suffer this incredibly painful death, he first is going to be whipped by the soldiers. It says in chapter 15, beginning in 16, the soldiers took Jesus into the palace and called together the entire brigade. They dressed him up in purple and put a crown plaited from a thorn bush on his head. Then they began their mockery. Bravo, King of the Jews! They banged on his head with a club, spit on him, and knelt down in mock worship. After they had had their fun, they took off the purple cape and put his own clothes back on him. Then they marched him out to nail him to the cross. Jesus is taken. He's beaten. He's mocked. And then the soldiers put his clothes back on so he can begin that painful walk to the cross. And they bring him to a place called Golgotha. And I, for a long time, pictured, as many of you maybe have too, this kind of image of crosses up on a hill. But that's probably not what it was like, because crucifixion was reserved for only the worst criminals under the Roman Empire, and really primarily for insurrectionists, for those who threatened or challenged Roman authority. And so with crucifixion, Rome wanted to send a very clear message. Don't challenge the empire. Don't you mess with us, because if you do, this is what's going to happen. And so the crosses most likely would have been right next to the road. Then everybody coming or going would have had to walk right by, probably close enough to the road that they could have touched those men on the crosses. They nailed him up at 9 o'clock in the morning. The charge against him, the King of the Jews, was printed on a poster. Along with him, they crucified two criminals, one to his right, the other to his left. People passing along the road jeered, shaking their heads in mock lament. You bragged that you could tear down the temple and then rebuild it in 3 days. So show us your stuff. Save yourself. If you're really God's son, come down from that cross. Imagine that it had to have taken Jesus a lot of self-control. Because if he had wanted to, he could have just jumped down. But instead, he hangs there. He hears their mocking. And it really seems like at this point that Jesus has reached the ultimate low point. He's been betrayed, abandoned by his closest friends. He's been beaten and mocked. And now he hangs here naked on a cross. The most humiliating and painful way to die. As a pastor, and really just a Christian in general, one of the most common reasons I hear that people leave the church or reject faith altogether, whether they've been a part of it and walk away or have never accepted faith, one of the reasons I often hear is because they say a good God would never allow people to suffer. Many people say, if God was really good, then people wouldn't suffer like they do, especially innocent people. And what I want to say when I hear that is, do you know about Jesus? Because here Jesus is, the only truly innocent person to ever walk the face of the earth. And he is suffering beyond what many of us can imagine. At noon, the sky became extremely dark. The darkness lasted 3 hours. At 3 o'clock, Jesus groaned out of the depths, crying loudly, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you abandoned me? My God, why have you abandoned me? If you've ever cried out, if you've ever cried out to God and you've felt like no one was listening, if you've ever begged with God, pleaded that God would intervene to the point that you're so desperate that you don't even care if you get what you want, you just want God to answer, to give you something so that you know that God is there. If you've ever wondered if God is here at all, if God has left you, Jesus has been there too. Because if there was ever a moment that Jesus needed a little bit of encouragement, if there was ever really a moment where Jesus might have needed God to answer his prayers, there was ever a time that he wanted to hear those words. This is my beloved in whom I am well pleased. Be right now. And yet Jesus cries out, my God, why have you abandoned me? Silence. There's nothing. And suddenly all of those other things that have happened leading up to this point, they just pale in comparison. Because feeling abandoned by God, there's nothing worse. One of the requirements for clergy to be ordained is we have to do a chaplaincy internship. And so I did mine while I was still in seminary at UNC Hospital. And some of you maybe have heard me talk about this before. I served as an intern, and UNC is a huge hospital, Trauma One. And part of what all the interns had to do was serve nights on call. And those were some really hard nights in some cases. And my first night on call was a Friday night, and I was already super nervous about it. And not that long into the night, there was a bad car accident that involved three teenagers. And I went down to the emergency room, and it became clear after being down there for a few minutes that while two were hurt pretty badly, that their prognosis ultimately was pretty good. But the third, a girl, was in bad shape. And she'd been brought in by a chopper, and so her family wasn't there yet. So I'd kind of been down there for a while and got a sense of the scene, and then knew that I'd get paged when her family arrived. And when they did, I quickly learned that her parents were divorced, and there was a lot of other family dynamics in play, and the mother was there. And as you can imagine, she was beside herself. She was absolutely in pieces, and she found herself really alone because of all the other family drama that was circulating around her. And it was my task as the chaplain to be there and really just serve as a reminder that God is present here with you, even in the midst of this. But I was 24 and terrified and never done an on-call before. And so when it seemed like we should pray, I found myself in that prayer begging, God, I know you're here. I believe you're here. But God, I really need to actually know that. God, can you please give her and me some kind of sign, some kind of indication that you are in fact here with us in the midst of all of this? And what I've realized, sometimes in the moment or just kind of barely in hindsight of some of the most painful and the lonely times in my life, that I found strange comfort in knowing that Jesus felt that way too. That Jesus felt abandoned and alone and found himself crying out for God. And yet, even feeling that way, it didn't stop Jesus from enduring through the end. And the other thing is that no matter how Jesus felt, I think God was present. Because it says, starting in verse 37, but Jesus, with a loud cry, gave his last breath. At that moment, the temple curtain ripped right down the middle. When the Roman captain, standing guard in front of him, saw that he had quit breathing, he said, this has to be the Son of God. When we read this in staff this week, somebody asked, what do you think happened that caused this guard to know that Jesus was the Son of God? Because this guy wasn't Jewish. He wouldn't have been a follower of Jesus. He was a Roman guard who was probably part of another pagan religion. And yet something about seeing all of this unfold led this man to declare this had to be the Son of God. It was a moment of conversion for this soldier. And so somehow God had to have been present in the midst of that. Well, this week it's going to get worse before it gets better. Because as we get to Friday, we're going to find Jesus when he feels completely abandoned and alone. even abandoned by God. But if you've ever felt that way, if you feel that way right now, you're not alone. Hold on, because God's not finished yet. Amen.